This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're on social media, you may well have seen or even signed one of the many petitions and articles swirling around that express shock, anger, and confusion over the killing of a lion in Zimbabwe, a lion that had come to be known to park visitors as Cecil. Ahead this hour, we're going to talk with Laurel Neamy, a Vermont writer who has extensively researched and consulted on the laws that prevent poaching and trafficking of wildlife. She says the legal implications in this case are a little more complicated than some would like them to be. So if you have questions about what happens in poaching cases, why conservation efforts are sometimes helped by legal big game hunting, and how U.S. and international law intersect, you can send a note right now to vermontedition@vpr.net. Laurel Neamy will join us in about 10 minutes. But first, a little Vermont history. When it comes to Revolutionary-era forts on Lake Champlain, Mount Independence seems to get short shrift behind others, like Fort Ticonderoga. Actually, those two forts were connected by a bridge, and Mount Independence housed three times as many soldiers as Fort Ty in 1776. Mount Independence in Orwell is one of just nine state historic sites that are maintained for visitors, where locals and tourists alike can learn about Vermont history. Mount Independence Visitor Center is shaped like an overturned boat, and VPR's Rick Singeri recently visited the site and got a dive into Vermont's Revolutionary War history with site interpreter Paul Andrischen.
Paul, first of all, what's the importance of this particular site, Mount Independence?
Well, this particular site was part of the northern defenses during the American Revolution. Together with Fort Ticonderoga, known as the Gibraltar of the North, this was the greatest impediment the British had to moving south from Canada, or British North America at the time, to try to take the colonies over. And they made two attempts at it in 1776 and again in 1777. In 1777, they were successful.
What actually happened on this site?
Well, on this particular site, in the summer, roughly starting the end of June, early July 1776, construction began here. This peninsula faces north into Lake Champlain. Fort Ticonderoga faces south. The threat's coming from the other way. But if you look at a map, the lake actually makes a bit of an S-turn here. And by putting cannon on both shores, creating shore batteries, you're going to make it very difficult for anybody to come past this particular location. And the officers realized that they needed to do something. This was all wilderness over here. So they began construction in earnest about that time and turned this into a military installation, where about three-quarters of the troops that were stationed here were stationed on this side of the lake, the other quarter on the Fort Ticonderoga side. During the American Revolution, strategically, this was the more viable spot simply because of the direction it faced. Fort Ticonderoga was destroyed partially by the French. The British didn't do much with it. The Americans now are beginning to build that up as well. And this turned into a huge, I mean, you don't realize how many people were here. There were between 12 and 13,000 people here, roughly from, let's say, August until late October of 1776. There were more people here at the time than there were in the city of Boston, which is really hard to believe. This is the ruins of a city. And if you are careful what you're looking for, it's difficult because of the vegetation up this time of year. But there are foundations that you can see as you're walking our trails. There's all different sorts of residue from this particular occupation here.
So take me back to 1776. If I'm here, what will I see on this site at Mount Independence?
Wow. You would probably see activity that you would be just absolutely mesmerized with everything that was going on here. At any given time, you would have men drilling, you would have men building, you would have people on wood patrols going out to get firewood, cooking food, doing guard duty, any possible thing. And when we talk people, we're not just talking men. We're talking men, women, and children, everybody here at the same time. It would have been a beehive of activity, construction and everything. And that went on almost the entire time that this was occupied.
And tell me about the battles that took place here.
There were no battles that took place here in reality. There was a repulse of Sir Guy Carleton coming down from Canada in October 1776, but the actual action took place farther up the lake around Valcour Island. What was left of the remnants of the American fleet came back down here. And when Carleton came down here and saw the predicament he would have to try to go through to get this place, he went home. The lake was already starting to freeze in October. The weather was colder, and reports of snow on the mountains in the Adirondacks and Green Mountains and the lake freezing in October were already part of this. So they gave up. The next year, Burgoyne came through. By that time, the garrison had dwindled to roughly 3,000 to 5,000, and it was a complete disaster for the Americans. They began to be encircled. Burgoyne put cannon on Mount Defiance on the New York side, and the position became untenable. Arthur Sinclair, the officer in charge here, ordered a retreat, and the men left as orderly as they could, and it turned into a rout in the middle of the night. But the British occupied it, stayed here roughly till the end of October. The Americans tried to take this place in September and failed. There was an assault on this particular location by American troops, defended by German and British troops that were here.
Paul, what will people find when they come to the site of Mount Independence today?
Today we have a system of hiking trails. We have a wheelchair-accessible trail that is really exceptional. The other trails hook onto it. You can do a 3.5, just slightly less than 3.5-mile loop walking from this building out to the point of the peninsula and back on our trails. Some are a little difficult. Most of them are really easy. And what you'll see when you're walking through are the remnants of the encampment that was here. Many of the sites are marked well. On the Baldwin Trail, the wheelchair-accessible trail, there's an exposed officers' cabin. There's some blockhouses, some southern defense batteries. There's quite a bit. If you're a military historian, there's a lot to see here. If you just like nature, there's a lot to see here. It's beautiful. The views are spectacular. The Blue Trail will take you down along, eventually down along the lake where the quarry was. The gardens were there that the soldiers used. The Orange Trail, you're going through the Star Fort. You'll be going past the Crane site where Crane brought supplies up from Catfish Bay. There's a horseshoe battery out there. The shore battery's there. And, of course, right on the edge of the peninsula is where the bridge went across to Ticonderoga. The piers are still in the water. It's quite a spectacular spot to just sit there. Nice big rocks. You can sit and just enjoy the day. There's always something to see here.
You have a beautiful visitor center with a unique shape. Explain what this is supposed to be.
Well, it's built to look like a bateau, and that's just a French word for boat. A bateau at the time was 40 to 50 feet long, like a canoe barge that would have been used to haul supplies, men up and down the lake. There would have been hundreds of them out here. And it's a great design. It kind of commemorates the fact that the lake is here. The bateaus were useful here. And it just works out really nice as a design for the building. It's eye-catching, and there's a lot more room in here than you might think.
Can you show me a few things inside the museum?
Sure. Let's see what you want to see over here. This Powderhorn, it's one of those priceless pieces. It does have a map of the Star Fort and some of the other fortification inscribed on the Powderhorn. And it's a completely unique item. There's one other similar to that over at Fort Ticonderoga. Some of the other more interesting things is we do have a talking statue display. The statues will talk. There's an American soldier on this side. There's a British soldier on that side.
The militia alike was certain that the long-anticipated confrontation was imminent. The fortifying of the mount had been proceeding very rapidly. The bridge to Ticonderoga had been completed. Even the hospital with room enough for 600 sick and wounded.
They give you the story of what their life was like here on the mount, and it's taken from excerpts from diaries and letters, so it's not just one person, it's a composite. We have a 28-pound cannon that was brought up out of the lake. If you watch our orientation film, you'll see that coming up in 1992 when we had the dig. We have, of course, we have the artillery pieces. There are some bar shot and some heavy shells and some grape shot that would have been used. Lots of other artifacts, some cooking pots, glasses, plates, wine bottles. We find lots of wine bottles. They seem to enjoy wine over here. As far as other things go, oh, yeah, we'll go over here. I'll show you. We have a mural that was painted, and it depicts what the mountain would look like with the trees gone. You can see where the hospital site is, the Star Fort, the Horseshoe Battery, the Shore Batteries, the bridge, of course, Fort Ticonderoga, and it's painted from a perspective of standing on Mount Defiance over New York looking down into this installation. If you're interested in history, of course, there's a lot here to see. It's great for kids. I mean, there's just a little bit here for everybody. You don't have to be a historian to come here.
Paul and Andrischian, thanks so much for taking us around Mount Independence.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Paul Andrischian is a site interpreter at the Mount Independence State Historic Site in Orwell. He talked with VPR's Rick Singeri. The Mount Independence Visitors Center is open through Columbus Day. You can learn more at vpr.net. Coming up, we'll learn about the legal issues pertaining to the killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe and why this killing has raised the ire of people who are taking to social media to express their rage when so many poaching cases don't get the same attention. If you have a question about what's legal and not legal when it comes to big game hunting, call now. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. By now, you've probably heard that a famous lion in Zimbabwe was killed by a dentist from Minnesota. Walter Palmer claims he thought the hunt was fully legal, but his two Zimbabwean guides have already been arrested, and questions remain about whether Palmer will face legal troubles. Certainly, his reputation and his business have already suffered. Palmer's dental practice remains closed, and news reports say today he has gone into seclusion. If the reaction on social media is a good indicator, Palmer is now the one with the target on his back. Animal lovers are outraged about Cecil's killing. They're calling for the prosecution of Palmer, and some people are venting that they would prefer an eye for an eye. But if we step back from the sheer anger and sadness that many people seem to feel, there are a lot of very complicated legal questions surrounding this case, and that's what we're going to focus on today, the U.S. and international laws that have been set up to safeguard threatened and endangered animals and how they might be applied in this case. We'll also look at conservation efforts that include big game hunting and why some officials say the money that goes into conservation efforts from these limited hunts is ironically crucial to the protection of the species. We're joined now by Vermont writer Laurel Neamy, who has extensively researched and worked on the legal protections that prevent wildlife poaching and trafficking. We have interviewed her previously about her book, Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Laurel, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let me just ask you first, what was your reaction when you heard this story?
Well, of course I didn't like it because of a lot of, in my mind, questionable ethical hunting practices that were involved related to this case. Most notably that they were baiting the animal out of the park, luring it out of the park. Now, when I say unethical, I do not mean illegal, because in Zimbabwe, it is legal to bait and it is legal to shoot a collared animal and it is legal to shoot from a blind. But even the Zimbabwe Professional Hunters Association has called a lot of those practices unethical.
So regardless of the legality, you were troubled by what you saw in this hunt, just in the way it was conducted?
Just in the way it was conducted.
Were you surprised by how much traction it has gotten on social media?
In some ways, I have been surprised. There have been a number of other cases where lions or leopards or other animals, elephants, have been shot in equally troubling circumstances. There are a number of cases where rhinoceros have been sport hunted, also using what appears to be fraudulent permits. And so the practices and elements of this case are similar to a lot of other cases. I think because Cecil is an iconic lion, and a lot of people knew him and followed him, and he's so majestic. It hits home a little bit more, and it brings a lot of these issues to the forefront, which I think is a good outcome of a problematic hunt.
We did get a note from Kimber who wrote in to say, well, what about all the other lions, the ones without names?
And that's true. That's a really good point, because, again, Cecil might be the famous one, but he's not the only one. In fact, he was part of a research study to show at Oxford University. I'm sure people have heard that Cecil was collared, which is why we know so much about where he was shot and when. And in that study, they were studying the effects of sport hunting on the lion population. And in that study, out of little over 60 tagged lions, over half of them died during the study process, of which 24 of that was sport hunted.
Wow. We're getting, as you might imagine, comments coming in to our posts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page and the VPR Facebook page. Donna says, it should all be illegal. Killing for fun is evil. We got a note from Megan who says, I wish that we as humans could evolve further along than thinking it's a thrill to randomly kill wild animals. What happened to Cecil is beyond disgusting, but it still happens all over the world, and I think it's barbaric. Hunting for food feels differently to me, Megan says, than killing for the sport of it. And then Christy says the guy was poaching. He'd been tried back in 2008 for a similar method to bag a bear. Poachers are everywhere and they ruin the good name of hunters. Hunting is paramount to a healthy animal population and ecosystem. What Palmer did was driven by ego and greed and nothing more. Real men, real hunters don't poach, she says. Let's talk a little bit, Laurel, about the possible legal ramifications of this case. So I'm going to ask you to break it down first to talk a little bit about Palmer, to talk about Zimbabwean law, to talk about international law on cases like this, and then U.S. law. So as I mentioned, the two men from Zimbabwe who were with Palmer, who were acting as his guides, have been arrested. And Zimbabwean officials have said they're looking for Palmer in connection with the killing. It does seem, though, that he's back in the United States. So from what you know of the laws in Zimbabwe, could he be extradited and tried for something in Zimbabwe?
So I'm not sure if he could be extradited because I don't know enough about the extradition process and procedures. In Zimbabwe, like I said, it is legal to bait the animal and it is legal to kill the collared animal. Whether or not that's ethical, I think where the legality in Zimbabwe is occurring is that it is legal to hunt in Zimbabwe with a permit. And the permits are allocated based on hunting quotas in particular areas. And it's to maintain a healthy population. In theory, what happens in practice all over the world is that sometimes those permits are used twice, three times, four times. There's a lot of fraud that can occur with those permits. And so in this case, what I'm hearing is that the permit, it was shot in an area that did not have a permit. And typically what would happen with a hunt like that is often the lion would be moved or the animal would be moved to another location, and therefore it's claimed that it was shot elsewhere. And that happens in the United States. It happens all over the world. And it's not appropriate because then the management of that species can't be managed properly because you're shooting out of the location in which the populations are healthier.
And that couldn't happen in this case because Cecil had the radio collar.
Correct. And so that's where you have more proof about where this all transpired. And so in this case, that's the legality. The hunter in this case had a right to, you know, pay for the hunt, and that's something he did. Whether or not he knew that this was – whether the permit was – involving that location or not.
Right. He says he relied on his guides to have all of the proper legal permits and qualifications for doing this hunting, and that he claims at least that he thought it was all above board and fully legal.
And that's where in a lot of these cases, and that's where a lot of the question comes in, because the U.S. prosecution can happen when the hunter or the person knowingly commits that crime. And in this case, it's unclear whether or not a hunter should have engaged in unethical practices is another issue entirely, because there's a lot of elements of this case that are sort of gruesome. And I think that's triggering a lot of the emotion as well.
The fact that the lion was injured and they tracked it for 40 hours before they finally killed it. Is that what you're referring
Correct.
To?
Correct. So it was shot at night. You didn't have good eyesight. How could you know it didn't have the radio collar? Although it was legal to shoot the animal with a radio collar. So the identification, I mean, that happens here in the United States too, sure, where you shoot a wolf instead of a coyote because you didn't identify the target. And that's inappropriate behavior, and you're supposed to identify your target.
And maybe illegal, depending on how it's interpreted.
It all depends. It's laws are very murky.
Well, and we're talking about those today with Laurel Neamy. She knows a lot about animal poaching. She knows a lot about the international laws surrounding trafficking and poaching. And if you have a question for her, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Robert says the zone in which the lion was shot is not one in which it was legal to shoot a lion, which makes the legal implications very clear. The lion was poached, which makes it legally wrong, regardless of one's personal opinion about the morality of hunting lions. KT in Saxton's River says, I can barely stand to see the photos of this magnificent creature, knowing he's been murdered by this sorry excuse for a human being. No mincing of words or beliefs from my camp. He is scum. And if there was anything legal about what he did, it needs to be changed to a seriously punishable illegal offense. Jean says online, I heard a discussion of this on the BBC. They mentioned that the point of the hunt was not to kill the animal, but to track it. It was the human outsmarting the animal, finding it without revealing the human's presence. They also mentioned that hunting was good for the local economy, but why then can't the hunter use tranquilizer darts? You could have the thrill of the hunt, support the local economy, but not be so heartless as to kill these amazing animals. And we're going to get into some of the reasons why Jean says she's been hearing that there might be some support for the local economy and some support for conservation later on. But Laurel, do you think it would make any sense to do something like have sport shooting that didn't kill the animal?
There is some of that called green hunts in South Africa, where they use tranquilizers and then the hunter poses with the animal. And I should say that a lot of time hunters are some of the best conservationists. They love the idea of being outdoors, and they know a lot about the animals. And throughout Africa, a lot of former poachers are now some of the best rangers out there, because they have a lot of the skill sets for tracking animals as well. And the hunting, in terms of conservation, it can be a useful management tool. It can keep a lot of eyes on what's going on in the area as well. I think what happens in practice is a lot of times the money that comes in from the hunt does not necessarily go back to conservation. I've heard different reports, and, you know, it obviously depends on the location, you know, where you're talking about and the government and administrative authorities, but sometimes as low as 3% goes back into that. And so in that case, maybe not.
Well, okay. But so since you're going there, let's talk a little bit more about that, because how much money does come in from these legal hunts every year in Africa for big game hunting in Africa? Do you have numbers?
It could be big business. I don't have numbers offhand. I know that, you know, this hunt, reportedly, Palmer paid $55,000 for a hunt in South Africa for canned lion hunts, which are lions are often raised and then hunted in a sort of non-fair chase situation, which is what occurred here, but in that case, lions that were bred specifically to be hunted. It costs about $20,000, but for a wild lion, it's $75,000. So the prices can be all over the place, and they're big ticket items. And the U.S. is the largest importer of lion trophies in the world, and U.S. sportsmen make up the largest proportion of trophy hunters.
But you're saying that often that money doesn't actually go towards conservation efforts, even though that's one of the defenses that people often have of this kind of big game hunting.
Yeah, it's unclear. It's unclear. And so it obviously depends on the country and the controls in place. And some places are much better than others. And when you have, $75,000 going to a community, that community could very well be much more interested in keeping eyes out and not killing the animals themselves, because you also have issues related to human-wildlife conflict. So on the ground, there's also the need to have an incentive for local people to protect the animals, because a lot of times they would be killed. You know, elephants raid crops, lions take cattle and livestock. And so there is a good reason to have an incentive for local communities. And sometimes that incentive does come from allocation of the money, the revenue from hunting fees and hunting quotas.
We're talking today about the complicated legal issues surrounding animal poaching and big game hunting. And our guest, Laurel Nimi, has some insight into how the situation with the dentist who killed Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe might play out. Listeners, we would love to know what questions you have. I know there's a lot of outrage, but do you feel like you're clear on where the lines are drawn both legally and ethically, or about why some people do defend this big game hunting in Africa as a way to help support conservation efforts? We're having some trouble with our phone, so I would invite you to email us. You can write to vermontedition@vpr.net or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We have a conversation going on there, and you can weigh in. We're going to read some of your comments coming up. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the laws, particularly U.S. laws, and what are designed to help stop trafficking and poaching in the U.S. Again, if you have a question, go to the Vermont Edition page on Facebook, or you can write to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been taking stock of the facts surrounding the killing of Cecil the Lion and how both international and U.S. laws might be applied to punish the American hunter responsible for the lion's death. That certainly seems to be what many people on social media are hoping for, those who have not gone the route, hypothetical, we hope, of retribution. But Cecil the Lion is not the only animal threatened with human predation, sometimes legally. There was a lot of outrage last year when a Texas hunter won an auction that allowed him to kill an older black rhino, a male. That hunt happened this past May. So we're going to spend some time now looking at the U.S. laws surrounding animal trafficking and poaching, and also a little bit more broadly at the issues surrounding conservation and poaching, and what can be done, how that outrage that people are feeling on social media can be channeled into conservation efforts. We're getting a lot of comments. As I mentioned, you should post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or you can write to us, vermontedition@vpr.net. We're having a little trouble with the phones today, so sending us a note is the best way to get in touch. Earl says, I am a hunter. Nothing irritates me more than poaching and giving hunting a bad reputation. I think it's unfair to call this poaching when it appears this may have all been done legally, even if there may be ethical questions. Anti-hunters are just using Cecil to promote their agenda. Earl, I'm not sure you're right. It sounds like the permits were not gotten in this case, so it sounds like there was something illegal happening, even if lion hunts in themselves are sometimes legal. Brenna writes in, Brenna Galdenzi, she heads a Vermont group called Protect Our Wildlife. She writes, I'd like to bring attention to the local big game trophy hunting, which occurs here in Vermont. Can trophy hunting ever be considered conservation if the hunters are taking the largest, presumably healthiest, moose, bear, and other game species? Shouldn't these larger alpha animals be allowed to procreate for the betterment of the overall population's health? Marco says, this is an example of where a prohibition needs to be stronger. Too many endangered species will die off if something isn't done about poachers. There are only 4 white rhinos left in existence because of poachers. And I looked that up this morning. I think this is the northern white rhino. Is
correct,
that right, Laurel?
Yeah.
That there are just a few and they live in sanctuaries. The southern white rhino population is a little bit stronger than
correct.
That. And then there are, of course, black rhinos as well, which are endangered,
critically endangered.
And P-Town says, could Cecil's death bring needed attention to the issues around big game trophy hunting? So lots of questions, lots of thoughts from our listeners here. I want to make sure we touch on U.S. laws and how they might be applied in a case like this with Cecil the Lion and with the American who shot him and killed him before we get into some of these bigger issues, Laurel, if you don't mind. So in terms of U.S. law, is there anything that could happen to Walter Palmer?
So that's a good question, and it depends. It's not very satisfying, but it depends. And I don't know the specifics of his knowledge. And so that is something I'm sure the Fish and Wildlife Service would be investigating. And I should say that, you know, the lion populations have declined significantly over the past 30 years. They've been declined 60% to about 30,000, 32,000 African lions currently. And so that's not a huge population. And the legal...
But they're not on the endangered species
correct.
List, right?
So they're listed... So what happens is there's several different levels. There's both at the international level where lions are listed in Appendix 2, which allows commercial use with a permit. And then there's also at the national level, so something like the Endangered Species Act, where lions have been considered, but a regulation hasn't been issued yet. And so that is some way that a lot of the social and media attention could be focused is in writing your legislators about trying to list the lion where it should be scientifically, given its population decline. Now, with lions, a lot of the population decline is also due to habitat loss. And so that's an issue separate from sport hunting, and sometimes allowing sport hunting actually preserves habitat in a different way. So it's very complicated. So at the in the U.S., because you asked about U.S. laws, there's the Endangered Species Act, which if lion were listed under that would prevent the import of the trophy.
So even though African lions are not native to the United States and aren't here, we could still have them listed nationally on our Endangered Species Act and
correct.
That would deal with the importation.
And then there's also the Lacey Act. And so the Lacey Act makes it a crime to knowingly sell in interstate or foreign commerce wildlife that's illegally taken, possessed, transported, or sold in violation of a foreign law. So depending what the laws are in the foreign country, in this case, Zimbabwe, if the hunt violated that, then prosecutors could go after those who knowingly sell that. Now,
So you're talking U.S. prosecutors. So U.S.
prosecutors
could go after a person who engaged in something that was illegal in that foreign country.
Correct. So in this case, so there was a case in October 2014 where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service indicted safari hunters in South Africa, safari outfitters in South Africa. And it was during a 5-year period, the outfitters had sold American hunters what ended up being illegal hunts according to South African law. And so what had happened in those cases, they had offered Americans the chance to conduct what was called green hunts, where you were talking about the tranquilizers, and then they could pose with a sedated animal, but they hadn't had the permits. And then a lot of times they said, oh, there's a problem animal, and they offered a cheap hunt for a rhino, and then the hunter would pose with the rhino, and then the outfitters would sell the horns elsewhere to Asia for medicine. And so in that case, the prosecutors did not prosecute the American hunters who participated in that. They prosecuted the safari outfitters who also had a base here in the United States through which they were selling the hunts. And so I don't know enough about the Zimbabwe situation to know whether how the American hunter Palmer had purchased his hunt. And so those types of things could be applicable, but may not be. I don't know enough about it.
We got a note from Frederick who says, I think trophy hunting, or shall we call it vanity poaching, is a mental illness. The need to spend that kind of money to behead a creature and stick it on your wall is a sickness. I also think this is a sad remnant of colonialism, where white men have gone to Africa and do whatever they please, regardless of the consequences. And then we got a couple notes on what's happening about on social media around this case. Margaret says, I'm so upset about this killing. I'm glad social media has allowed the name of this man to be spread around the world. I hope he is plagued by his actions for the rest of his life and that he is never allowed to pursue his, quote, hobby again. Maybe if the sport, again in quotation marks, of trophy hunting can finally come to an end because of this. And Allison says, karma is internet justice. So, Laurel Nimi, what do you think about what you're seeing on social media? I mean, it sounds like, from all accounts, Walter Palmer is being threatened. He's at least for now shut down his dental practice. Reports are he's gone into seclusion. So there's certainly a lot of anger and outrage that's being directed at him. What might be some more fruitful and productive ways to redirect that anger into conservation?
I think there's a lot of things people can do. One, which I mentioned, was related to the listing and the status of the African lion. And another is related to can be directed to what happens with the import of the lion trophy. There's a lot of room for decision-making there. And in fact, a number of countries have banned the import, banned hunting entirely, like Botswana and Zambia and Kenya. And also the U.S. has banned imports of elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Tanzania. So while lion trophies could still come in, there have been a lot of questions related to elephant trophies and whether hunting of that species that might – those elements might still apply here related to lions. So there's a lot of elements where people can become engaged. They could also look at the ethical practices and perhaps a moratorium on imports of lion trophies given the declining populations. Also, within African countries, the land use plans that allow more of a buffer zone around national parks instead of being able to have hunting concessions immediately outside national parks, and also related to ethical practices, so making more principles of fair chase codified in the laws.
What about money? I mean, you were talking earlier about how unclear it is how much money actually goes towards conservation efforts in big game hunting, but that's often held up as one of the benefits, that that there is some benefit to the local economy that might discourage other forms of poaching, or that some of this money is going directly into conservation efforts. And, you know, again, as you said, that's sort of murky territory. But what about people on social media and people who are interested in conservation? What do they do monetarily, or what can they do?
Because there's a number of organizations that deal with that address lions. The Big Cat Initiative, Lion Aid, Panthera are all good organizations that focus on these issues. And then related to sport hunting and illegal wildlife trafficking, things like International Fund for Animal Welfare related to elephants, you know, David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. So there's a lot of animal-related organizations that can benefit from additional funding in terms of the people who actually protect the animals. Something that's very forgotten is often the rangers who put their lives on the line. A lot of rangers die every year in the course of doing their duty, and the Thin Green Line Foundation helps those families of rangers killed in the line of duty, and also helps supply the International Ranger Federation. So there's a lot of different places one could put money that could really make a difference.
We got a note from Mark who says, just for general interest, Dr. Palmer's River Bluff Dental Practice in Bloomington, Minnesota has recently received nearly 1,100 one-star reviews on Yelp, most with some colorful commentary. Also for general interest, the website for River Bluff Dental is no longer in operation. No matter what happens legally, I think it's safe to say that Dr. Palmer's business has been ruined. Karma? Mark questions. Laurel, personally, when you see this, do you look cynically at all of these posts and say, yeah, but you're not actually doing anything to protect the animals? Or do you think that this is helpful to have this kind of attention drawn?
I think it's useful to have the attention drawn to the issue. As far as targeting this individual, I think, you know, I'd never agree with the threats being made. And a lot of times the worst punishment for that individual could be losing the right to hunt. And so, you know, maybe that's something that comes out of it. But whether or not it does, I think a lot of the social media attention can make changes, whether or not the laws change. Things like airlines have stopped carrying the trophies. So there's a number of airlines that have stopped carrying the trophies, and that's a private decision. It's a policy decision, so that's a lot of issues. Perhaps trying to make it harder to sell the hunts here, or to raise the issue of what's going on related to lion populations in general, because that's really the issue, is that lion populations are declining, and it's not just from hunting, but it's also from a lot of related to poisoning of to bait the lions in different ways. So it might not be shooting the animal that way straight out, but poisoning as well.
We got a note from Kestrel who says, while I find the death of Cecil horrifying and so, so sad, I find the hate being heaped upon the hunter also disturbing. While he is not a person I can understand, I am concerned about public shaming. There are many, many people who have done what he has, and he is paying the price for them all. So Kestrel echoing there some of, Laura, what you were saying. you wanted to
weigh in. Which is exactly how I feel. It's that public shaming, and because we don't really know all the ins and outs of how this hunt was conducted. I mean, I personally have a problem with the unethical, what appears to be a very unethical way of doing the hunt. And I think that's what's so disturbing. And if it was conducted and he mistakenly shot this lion, that might be something different and not provoke that outrage. But I think a lot of it is what feels like just a wrong kind of hunt, the baiting.
Laurel, before we let you go, do you think wildlife laws are strong enough internationally to protect against illegal poaching and wildlife trafficking, or do you still hope that there's more strengthening?
I think that there's I certainly do hope that there's a lot more strengthening going on because there's a lot of loopholes in the law. And I think therein lies the problem. I mean, even U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service special agents don't have the same enforcement powers that, say, Drug Enforcement Administration agents have. And there's bills right now before Congress that are limiting what they can do, that limit their enforcement powers. There's also a bill in the Department of Interior budget that is preventing them from issuing certain regulations on sage grouse and on elephant ivory. And so there's a lot of political constraints that are happening to enforcement. So there's a lot of loopholes that make enforcement unclear as well. And trying to strengthen that is a big way to go, I think, toward better enforcement. Better protection.
That's Laurel Neamy. She's the author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. She works out of Vermont. Laurel, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, we had a feisty hour-long discussion about junk, a perennial issue for town officials and disgruntled neighbors who disagree about what constitutes junk, especially when it's sitting in public view.
There's a lot of variation around the state in terms of people's tolerance levels for junk.
That's the understatement of the year from one of our guests, Karen Horn of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. And here are a few more voices from listeners who called in during the show.
I live next door to a guy that's got just tons of junk, and I was told there was nothing we could do about it.
I've got a yard full of, like, 27 cars. I have a bunch of new neighbors that moved in from down country that absolutely despise me.
Having a neighbor next door who had a tractor-trailer truck parked and buried in the backyard with various boats and tractors and fishing shanties all on 1 acre of property was a deterrent to trying to sell my home.
You should go take a look around and see if you're going to be comfortable in the neighborhood. It'd be like buying a house at the end of a runway and then complaining about airport traffic.
Everybody that lives in Vermont should have the freedom to do what they want with their own property.
I have a hard time hearing people say that it's none of your damn business what I do with my land. It's not just your land.
What to do? You know, talk to your neighbor. People that are angry and antagonistic are not going to get anywhere, I think.
And the comments just kept coming after the broadcast. Managing producer Patty Daniels joins me now to read some junk mail. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. So we also heard from Tom, who posted on Facebook, "This points to the larger issue of individual rights trumping societal responsibility. There needs to be more of a focus on how an individual's behavior does impact the greater society. One must accept one's responsibility to others."
And Ingrid, a real estate broker in Saxton's River, writes, "I see how being next to a property filled with junk and debris is a detriment to selling. I like the fact that in my village, people have a reasonable tolerance for some peeling paint and weeds in the yard, but it can go too far in the other direction. There's a greater tolerance for junk in yards in rural parts of Vermont, where people tend to live on larger parcels. Villages and towns, not so much. And I think that makes sense."
And a listener going by the name In the Flood Zone posted this comment, "I can't help the thought that many Vermont transplants have moved here the way some people get married. Overlook the obvious flaws and vow to change the other person once you've made the commitment."
Who would do that?
Who?
Robert in West Paulette posted to Facebook, "I think if Vermont says billboards are an eyesore, then excess junk in people's yards is an eyesore too and needs to be addressed."
And John says, "Here's a thought. You pay taxes, you own your land, you live on your land, you have possessions on your land. End of story.
Lori in Moncton posted this on Facebook. I'm always struck by how many complainers haven't bothered to speak directly to their neighbors. It's amazing how face-to-face conversation and listening can lead to understanding, if not a resolution. While I'm sympathetic to the issue of property values, if it isn't a health hazard, perhaps it is incumbent on the complainant to screen their own view.
And finally, we'll end with Kim's comment. She made a connection between this topic and another issue. Kim writes, hoarding is a mental illness, and there are different degrees of the problem. I think that resources should be made available to help people get rid of stuff while trying to keep that stuff out of the landfill. More swap shops or reuse zones should be available. Education and support go a lot farther than complaining.
Well, keep your comments coming on this topic or any other. We're on social media at Vermont Edition.
Or you can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net.
Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
And that will wrap up today's show. Tomorrow, working out a plan on solar power. Vermont's push for renewable energy will mean new solar projects and lots of them. So what's the process of deciding what they'll look like and where they'll go? Send your questions or comments about solar siting and solar in general to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us for the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Alex Keefe directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.